You're listening to the Rational Alchemy Interviews.
Dr. Morgan Levy is a UCLA-trained geriatric psychiatrist and an Alzheimer's disease researcher. He recently wrote an online book about the alternative medicine phenomenon called placebo medicine. He coined the term non-pharmacologic intervention, or NPI, which refers to all forms of medical therapy that are not physiologically active. He's here to discuss a recent study on acupuncture. Welcome to the show.
Hello, it's nice to be here.
All right, why don't you summarize this acupuncture study, first of all?
This study came out in the Archives of Internal Medicine, the May 11th, 2009 issue. The title of the study is A Randomized Trial Comparing Acupuncture, Simulated Acupuncture, and Usual Care for Chronic Low Back Pain. And the point of the study, and this is actually a fairly well-done study. As you know, recently they've been doing pretty good science on a lot of these complementary and alternative medicine therapies. And this one is actually a particularly good, solid study. It's double-blind, or at least as double-blind as you can get with acupuncture, and placebo-controlled with a large group of patients, 638. Basically, they divided them into four groups. One group just got usual care. Two groups got acupuncture, an individualized form of acupuncture and a standardized form of acupuncture. And then one group actually got sham acupuncture, where they sort of faked sticking a needle in. They actually had this tube, and the tube either contained a needle or a toothpick, and you didn't really know which one you were getting.
Okay.
And so the bottom line of the study was that all three of the groups, the individualized acupuncture, the regular acupuncture and the sham acupuncture, all did pretty well, and they were all significantly more effective than usual care.
What is usual care in this case?
Usual care for low back pain would just be taking non-steroidal anti-inflammatories or going to your physical therapist or just whatever your usual care is. Basically, a group of people that had low back pain that were treating themselves in whatever way but were not using acupuncture.
Okay.
And all of the acupuncture – all of the people in the study were acupuncture naive. They were people who were coming to a university hospital seeking integrated care or, you know, complementary alternative medicine care, but none of them had ever done acupuncture before. So that's sort of the premise of the study. The results of the study, there's basically two things that you should consider to be significant. One thing is that acupuncture and sham acupuncture are better than usual care. The second thing is that sham acupuncture and acupuncture are no different.
So the people who got the toothpicks or the needles, it didn't matter. They had the same result.
Correct. And other studies have pretty clearly demonstrated that if you can pretty much stick the needle, you don't have to stick the needle in the meridian points. You can pretty much stick the needles anywhere you want, and you get the same effect. So basically, no matter how you do the acupuncture, whether you do it or not do it, whether it's sham acupuncture, whether you stick the needles in the wrong place or the wrong depth or whatever.
The in-acupuncture?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Any way you do it, you get the same results. But you get results that are better than usual care. And so I think as with the vast majority of the complementary and alternative medicine therapeutics that we're now sort of coming to a reasonable conclusion are all pretty much placebo – we really are coming to the very solid conclusion that acupuncture is placebo. But one of the points that I make in my placebo medicine book is that placebo can be pretty good medicine, and lots of placebos have different potencies, right? And it turns out that sticking needles in your body is a pretty potent way to deliver a placebo. So it's a pretty darn good placebo.
Okay, how about we just stick with toothpicks?
Well, my point is that, sometimes when you stick needles in bodies, you tend to hit things like arteries and stuff. So it's probably not a real good idea to it's not that often that acupuncture goes awry, but it does on occasion. So I would actually recommend that if one of these safe forms of acupuncture is just as effective as real acupuncture, why don't we use some of the safe forms? But the point is, you know, it doesn't matter. You could put magnets on your forehead and pretend like you're doing acupuncture, and it's just as effective as needles in acupuncture. So if we did that, we could still take advantage of the placebo effect of the acupuncture, and it would be better than usual care.
Okay, so what does this say for something like acupressure? I mean, you're still talking about it doesn't matter about the meridian points. It doesn't matter about qi. It doesn't matter about any of the sort of background of how we came to the practice of acupuncture. Everything that it's based on doesn't make one bit of difference. It's
correct.
Just that you're getting stuck with something sharp, and they're telling you that it's acupuncture?
No. In my opinion, what I think is the essential healing elements are the doctor-patient relationship, expectation factors, and conditioned responses, kind of like Pavlovian responses. These kinds of things that all go into making up the placebo effect. Also, just misperceiving that the therapeutic effect occurred. All of these types of things that go into the placebo effect are in effect when you're giving acupuncture. And so I think it pretty much clearly wipes out any idea that qi or meridian points are accurate when sham acupuncture is just as effective as you know, doesn't, you know, when that pretty much wipes out any of the theoretical reasons that even Western medicine doctors, when they first started using acupuncture, they thought, well, maybe it has to do with electrical conductivity of the skin or whatever, you know. But really, all of the theoretical ideas of why acupuncture might work, you got to throw them out when sham acupuncture and acupuncture are no different.
Well, we discussed this study very briefly as a news piece just after it had come out. And one of the things that we noticed immediately and picked up on was that what you just described wasn't the prevailing opinion of the news media. They all described it as proof that acupuncture works and is real. And that made no sense to me at all, since it had effectively destroyed the entire concept of meridians. But I think that has a lot to do with how medicine like this is portrayed anyway. And again, as we've discussed in the past, one of the reasons why we even do this show, because we don't get good representations of placebo, really, and what it means in the media. And I think it occurs to me, placebo medicine is probably the first kind of medicine that any of us have ever experienced. And what I mean by that is mommy kissing your boo-boo.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we probably experienced that before we'd had any real reason to visit a doctor other than for a checkup. And, you know, when I was a little kid, I was absolutely convinced that if my mom kissed my cut, the pain would go away, and it did.
You know what my first experience with placebo medicine was? My mother gave me some horrible stuff because I used to get carsick all the time. And she said that we ran out of the medication. The only way that I could get it is if I went to the doctor and I got an injection. That was the placebo. I was never carsick after that again.
So... well, what would you call that? It's not really a placebo, but it has...
It's fear. It's pain avoidance.
Well, one thing you could call it is a simple Pavlovian conditioned response. You know, for example, Pavlov figured out that dogs salivate when they see food. So if they paired a ringing a bell with the food and then he got rid of the food and just rang the bell, the dog would salivate, right? Well, you know, you have naturally occurring mechanisms to deal with acute stress to your body. For example, if you got a bacterial or a viral infection, or you broke your leg, or you had some insult to your body, your body would produce swelling or fever, or you'd get lethargic, or you'd lose your appetite. You know, your body has this response, right? And so it can be trained just like a Pavlovian response. In fact, you can even train allergic responses to act like Pavlovian responses, you know. So a lot of these types of responses. So, for example, if you're trained you go to the doctor and you get treatment and you get better and you do that a number of times and it sort of trains you. So, you know, you go to the doctor and you have one of these natural physiological responses. And, for example, pain response. It produces natural occurring endorphins, is particularly good at doing this sort of thing. So, for example, with acupuncture, as with hypnosis or as with other forms of placebos, with acupuncture, there's actually a study where they gave acupuncture for analgesia and did functional brain imaging. And you can see on the functional brain imaging parts of the brain that actually produce naturally occurring endorphins are active, and pain is actually getting relieved in these individuals, and all they're getting is acupuncture. And so, acupuncture is definitely effective for pain relief, but it's a placebo, because you can do the same thing with placebo pills. You can do the same thing with other forms of placebos and with hypnosis and these types. So it's not necessarily that the needle of the acupuncture is physiologically active, but it is acting like a placebo, and placebos are good medicine because of a lot of different reasons. But the reason that I think is most interesting is when you actually see real functional changes in your brain that correlate with real clinical improvement, and you've given something that's a non-pharmacological intervention. That's the aspect of placebo medicine that I think is the most interesting.
Well, so this study was done over a period of how many months?
The main study we're talking about?
Yes.
I think it was seven. I think there were 10 follow-ups, and they considered a patient, a participant, if they've at least made 8 of the follow-ups. I think there were weekly follow-ups, something like that.
So a couple of months.
Yeah.
2 or 3 months. I'm wondering how in the long term, fare up?
Actually, this study compared to previous studies really looked more at chronic, in other words, this was – it wasn't super chronic, but it was a relatively chronic treatment and response. And so whereas other previous studies have just looked at one incidence, this looked, does the treatment effect hold, over at least a
right.
moderate period of time?
Right. And would you have to continue the treatment for indefinitely to abate the pain, or would there be some sort of slacking off at some point?
If your question is the placebo effect acute or can it be chronic?
Right.
Right. That's a very interesting question. And I think people in my profession really kind of think that it's just an acute effect and it kind of wears off. But in reality, if you redefine it as non-pharmacological intervention, which gets rid of a lot of the stuff, because when you say placebo effect, you're talking about people who misperceive a therapeutic effect, people who are just having a Pavlovian response or,
right.
There's so many things that go into a placebo effect, right? But if we're talking about non-pharmacological intervention, we're talking about things like psychotherapy, hypnosis, sugar pills,
massage therapy.
Massage, yeah. So anything where you're not actually doing something physiologically active, yet you're actually getting a physiologically active event occurring in the body, right? And when you define it like that, it's a more narrow definition, but it sort of opens up a whole different realm of defining it, right? And so from that point of view, actually, I got off track and I don't remember what I was talking about.
that happens.
Happens to us all the time.
What we're talking about, is it a chronic or is it acute?
Oh, right. Is the placebo effect chronic? Is the placebo effect just an acute effect that kind of wears off quickly? Or so for example, with psychotherapy, you can treat depression, you can treat panic disorders, you can treat irritable bowel syndrome, you can treat lots of things, and you can train people how to, and treat themselves, and you can have chronic positive effects, over 6 months or 12 months or, and so, and this study that we just were talking about today, is several months. So I think the answer is yes, you can definitely have chronic, successful treatment through the use of non-pharmacological intervention.
But it's not just based on the acupuncture, but there are other things that you have to do. It's behavioral. You have to change a person's behavior and attitude towards their treatment.
Well, that's an interesting idea. And I will frame it like this. A lot of people consider the problem with the entire complementary and alternative medicine sphere of existence is that you cannot have deception in medicine. That
right.
is, you can't lie to patients, right?
Right.
And so I think that's why most people in organized medicine, that's the problem they have with complementary and alternative medicine. They see it as placebo, Placebo means you're lying to patients. You can't do that for in medicine, right? But I have a completely different orientation to this because I don't feel like you have to deceive anybody. I think you can have a full placebo effect with a fully informed patient. I don't think that to my knowledge, there's never been a study that showed or proved that deception was a requirement in order to have a placebo effect. In fact, drug companies spend billions of dollars every year to deal with the placebo effect. If deception was a requirement, all we would have to do is get rid of the deception, you would get rid of the placebo effect, and you wouldn't have to do a double-blind study, right?
Well, yeah.
So, I mean, there's several other pretty good arguments, and in fact, there are studies where people, you know, where they specifically, do get rid of the deception and you still get the placebo effect. For example, any clinical trial for any drug, you know, the people are told you're either going to get a placebo or the real treatment. You don't know which. Where's the deception? And the placebo effect still works. Even if you took placebo responders, even if you did a study and you got rid of all the placebo responders, did the study again, then you still get placebo responders. You know, so the idea that deception is a requirement for the placebo effect to work, I think is inaccurate. So what I think you could do is, I think, for example, as a physician, I could take my patient and I could, you know, maybe a somatic patient or somebody that has idiopathic chronic low back pain that I've evaluated and you know, there's no medical reason for it or whatever. And I could tell this patient, look, I'm going to send you to somebody who's going to do something that's a placebo. And I could totally explain placebo. I could even show functional brain images of people getting placebo and causing endorphin responses and clinically getting better. Explain to them that this acupuncturist is doing placebo. But if you really follow what they're saying and you really, you know, go with it, similar to a hypnotherapy type session, you know, then then you could produce natural endorphins and your pain in your elbow or your low back or whatever might be improved. And I could send that person to an acupuncturist and follow them up after they come back from the acupuncturist. And this fully informed, knowledgeable patient who's participating in the therapy, who goes to this non-pharmacological intervention specialist and comes back and their, you know, their back pain is improved purely by the placebo effect.
Are there any ways then that we could instill a placebo effect on ourselves?
Absolutely.
Because, you know, I see a lot of benefits to this, not the least of which would be potentially cutting down my bar tab.
And your cigarette bill.
Well, no, I need the cigarettes for the radio voice.
No, you don't.
But that's debatable. But but that's something like – well, actually, that's a very good example. I have tried quitting smoking using the, you know, so-called self-hypnosis methods, and they never really seem to do much of anything for me. But it, like, would there be potentially then a way that I could instill some kind of an effect upon myself, even if I know that it's just a placebo, that would actually work?
Yeah, hypnosis actually doesn't really work for quitting smoking, unless you really want to quit smoking. If you really don't want to quit,
help.
Which
really
Brian
want,
yeah. doesn't actually at the base of it, but.
but generally speaking, what you're saying is true. And so, for example, you know, there's lots of. I mean, if you're willing to practice, and you know, just like psychotherapy, like if you're doing cognitive behavioral psychotherapy, something you or you're doing hypnosis or self learning how to do self hypnosis. You know, these are things that you go and you want to do and you practice and you get really good at it and stuff, and then you're able to do it. And I, you know, I believe that you can do that with, you know, with whatever placebo medicine thing that you happen to like the best or know the most about or be the most familiar with, and then you could take advantage, you know, of the placebo effect. And there would be no deception at all. You could practice it and do it on yourself. And, you know, I think that's a real possibility.
Well, I think I've seen possibly an example of that in myself. I used to study Chinese martial arts, specifically Tai Chi and Wing Chun. I was never all that good at it. So if you find
Wing
me at
Chun
the bar,
tonight?
Don't,
Wing Chun?
Don't ask me to demonstrate. But, you know, in Chinese martial arts, they talk a lot about Qi flow and how when you're striking somebody, you're supposed to try to issue Fa Jing, which is which is chi, manifest into a physical energy that will harm your opponent. And, of course, I realize that full well that that's nonsense. I'm harming my opponent because I'm hitting him with my fist, and I'm doing it correctly. But it still was a very useful thing for me to imagine. And when we did, like, meditative techniques, which Tai Chi is filled with, we're supposed to imagine chi coming in from the heavens, circulating throughout our body, and then being recycled outward. And that's supposed to strengthen us and make the actual art and the combat stronger. And again, I knew that was complete nonsense, but it was very effective for me to get the moves right and to concentrate on what I was doing. So I guess that in some way could be an example of that.
It's a way to visualize, I think. And, you know, that brings up a question for me that I had. If we know that there are certain points on the body where you can cause pain or you can stop somebody from doing something, you can actually, you know, there is a Vulcan death grip place. You know, the police use it all the time, you know.
I can think of one very obvious spot as well.
Right. Well, yes. And you've shown me some martial arts move. I've had some training in that as well. But if we know that there are places where you can stop somebody's actions and you can cause definite, you know, changes in maybe a brain pattern or chemical or hormonal reaction to something, then why doesn't acupuncture work? Why can't we know how to do something about healing, especially pain, which is, I don't know, it is very subjective, but you'd think that there would also be points where we could help the body. Does that make any sense? I mean, if we can harm the body using certain points where nerves meet or certain, you know, blood vessels go, and it has a definite physical reaction, why wouldn't we expect that something acupuncture would work?
It definitely runs both ways. There's another word that's not quite as familiar to everybody called nocebo. A nocebo is exactly the opposite of a placebo. And, you know, a placebo is a sugar pill that makes your pain go away. A nocebo is a sugar pill that causes you to have pain. And so you can go either way on this, right? And so, for example, you could do acupuncture in a way that would cause pain.
Yes, you most certainly can.
Using a kitchen knife, perhaps?
No, for example, if the doctor-patient interaction or the acupuncturist interaction with the person getting the acupuncture, there's a really weird sound going out outside. We don't know what it is.
This is typical for KRFC. We just go with it.
So if the acupuncturist, you know, is giving acupuncture to a particular patient, but he's telling that patient that 5 minutes after you get this acupuncture, you're going to be in excruciating pain throughout your entire spinal cord. You know, a certain percentage of the patients, you know, getting this will experience that pain and have a nocebo effect.
That's like the power of suggestion.
You know, I think I've experienced that too. And like the kiss from the mother, I think it's also one of the first kinds of things that you experience in medicine. When you get an inoculation and you're old enough to notice what's going on, you assume it's going to hurt an awful lot, and it does. But once you realize that it's not really that painful, it stops being so. I remember being held down screaming when I was getting, you know, like a tetanus shot update or something. And I think that seems like it would probably qualify as a nocebo.
Yeah, in fact, actually, you know, children develop Pavlovian responses to people in white coats.
yeah. Especially with sharp instruments in their hands.
Yeah, they don't even need to have the sharp instrument.
No,
just the white coat is enough to send a four-year-old screaming out the door.
I think that also goes into something we've talked about quite a bit here, is that human perception is really crappy, and that we're terrible eyewitnesses. And matter of fact, eyewitness accounts are not that valid in a court of law anymore, because we've learned that what we perceive happened and what actually happened are very different things often. So it doesn't surprise me that we can easily manipulate that. There's a huge gap in which to play with human reaction to that, whether it's neurological or emotional or social. You know, we are very vulnerable to effects of suggestion and not necessarily trickery, but I like the phrase that you used to describe the subjects in the acupuncture research, and they were acupuncture naive. They didn't necessarily – they had never had it before. And so you kind of have to take people to a place where you reset their baseline and their expectation, and then you go from there. Because some people have had acupuncture before, mm-hmm. and then I don't know how that affects a placebo effect in that case.
Well, right. If you've had acupuncture before and it has helped you before, then that's, you know, further – influences it to help you again in the future.
Right.
Yeah, and that's part of the placebo effect.
What if you had a bad reaction to it, though? Or maybe even a slightly uncomfortable
reaction. Yeah, I mean, in fact, you know, us standard physicians, you know, we probably
the
do.
The normal guys?
Yeah, the organized medicine physicians, those of us that rush around too fast and don't have time to talk to you and don't have good bedside manner and you know, the what's that movie, House or whatever, that guy?
Oh, that, yeah, that, I that like guy that actually, show.
Yeah, I can't watch that show because, you know, it's like personally, I used to be that guy, you know, and so I
no way! You're so nice now.
I know. Well, you should see me, though, back, you know, I mean, anyways. So, so the thing is, though, that, you know, us regular organized physicians and what, we probably do a lot more nocebo than we do placebo in terms of our patient interactions. You know, we really have lost the heart of medicine in regards to treating our patients well to foster placebo. And I think we're doing a lot of nocebo, and I think that's what's driving a lot of people to complementary and alternative medicine, because you go to an acupuncturist and he specializes in treating you well and being in having a good doctor-patient relationship and really maximizing all the placebo effect stuff and making you feel good and all that kind of stuff. And you know, we're so scientific-oriented, we kind of drop the ball on that, I think. Hopefully we'll get it back.
But. So maybe less House and more Patch Adams?
Exactly.
Patch Adams. Woohoo! Beep, beep, wow.
Yeah, yeah. Nope. If House could learn a little Patch Adams, you know, then maybe we could compete with the complimentary folks.
Well, you are wearing a rather bright pink shirt, and that's a joyful thing. Thanks. Thanks. It makes good radio, too.
Now, I was thinking about this concept of, I guess, a voluntary placebo effect. And I'm wondering how powerful it really is. Like, for example, if I have a headache and I decide to give myself a sugar pill, even though I know it's just a sugar pill, is it powerful enough that it could do what I want it to? Or are there limits to what you're talking about?
Well, different people have different abilities to be able to do this. You know, some people are just absolutely I don't want to use the word suggestible. Some people are just incredibly suggestible, and then some people just aren't suggestible at all. Most people are sort of somewhere in the middle, but you know, if you're like an extremely suggestible person, chances are you could give yourself a sugar pill and cure your own headache with a total placebo effect. But you know, other people that aren't quite so suggestible, but that's really not the entirety of it. I mean, generally speaking, the majority of people are capable of some forms of self hypnosis to achieve, you know, things like that if you really, really want to. But, you know, to fool yourself into doing it, you know, probably not.
Well, that also made me wonder just about people in general. And you mentioned hypnosis. I've tried being hypnotized several times, and I just can't. It just doesn't work for me. Maybe I'm too much of a concrete thinker or whatever it is that goes into it. But I was wondering, with the placebo effect, I mean, it must affect different people differently. Have you ever noticed cases of people who aren't even really fooled by the placebo effect itself? I imagine everybody is to a degree, but does it have degrees of effectiveness?
Well, when you say placebo effect, again, you know, you're talking about so many different things, right?
I know, but it's hard for me to narrow down exactly.
Yeah.
So,
and that's why I coined the term non-pharmacological intervention to make it something that was more amenable to scientific inquiry and less confusing. But so it's difficult to address that question just because placebo effect includes so many different things.
Well, you're talking about placebo effect, and in case of acupuncture, being effective against I'm guessing, was it a chronic lower back pain?
Correct. These were all individuals.
These are not traumatic.
No, these were all individuals with idiopathic chronic low back pain. So in other words, they'd been to a doctor and there wasn't like a definite, you know, they didn't have like a tumor or something in their back.
Right.
There wasn't a definite injury or a definite cause. These are just chronic low back pain for, you know, it could have been arthritis or who
sure.
knows what. Yeah.
Right. Or it could have been a tennis game gone awfully wrong.
Exactly,
something like
yeah.
that. Okay. So what sort of things can placebo medicine, and particularly acupuncture, not deal with? What are they horrible at dropping the ball?
That's a great question. And the thing is, it's kind of the same for all forms of placebo medicine, whether we're talking about acupuncture, chiropractic, homeopathic care, or any of the zillions of complementary alternative medicines out there, as well as hypnosis and psychotherapy. All of these non-pharmacological interventions can't treat everything. I mean, if you have a real cancer, sticking needles in your butt is not going to get rid of it, right? But if you have, but there are certain things like low back pain,
yeah.
or anxiety, or insomnia, or a nausea, or in some cases, or other things like depressions or anxiety disorders, things like that. Some of those types of things are more amenable to non-pharmacological intervention. But clearly, if you have a clogged artery in your heart, there's no amount of non-pharmacological intervention that is going to, to cause that to get better.
Right. Now, all of the talk that I've heard lately, everything about alternative medicines, everything about, regular traditional medicinals, is all talking about boosting our immune systems. And I'm about at the end of my rope with boosting immune systems. And that's how we get something like Zicam. That if you spread a layer of zinc on your, soft tissue that enters your body and your mouth or your nose or whatever, you're going to protect yourself against germs. I think that's basically the idea. Because I used to take those throat lozenges, those lollipops that they had with the zinc. And it did. It totally deadened my sense of taste for a while. But it also, I didn't have as many problems with, getting a cold or whatever. It seemed to work. Whether it does or not. But you have these things meant to be barrier methods or sort of underlying the general health of your body and your immune system. Why are we so obsessed with that?
Well, there's a number of sort of catchphrases or catch concepts or sort of ideas that are generally spoken about in a very generalized way. When people are promoting all sorts of complementary alternative medicines, there's sort of a jargon. It doesn't matter if you're a chiropractor or an acupuncturist or a homeopath or, any number of complementary alternative medicine healers, they all talk in these, generalized terms like boosting the immune system. I'm a doctor. I don't really know what that means, So, these are just kind of ways to talk about it that don't make sense.
Right. I mean, it seems like the people who are doing all of these things like liver cleansing and, chiropractic or burning sage or whatever they're doing, they're the ones who get sick most often. And it seems like the more they strive towards boosting their immune system, the more diseased they are. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I have no idea if that is the case or not. But, there are, just because you have an illness doesn't necessarily mean that you have an immune deficient illness.
Right.
There's a lot of illnesses that are actually due to hyperactive immune systems.
Yes.
And if you give those people immune boosts, you're actually could be doing them harm.
No, don't do it.
So it's not necessarily that everything is going to respond well to an immune boost.
Right.
Even if that was a legitimate concept.
Well, silly things like the airborne, it was developed by a teacher. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, second grade teacher.
It was a second grade teacher.
Right.
Wow. Yeah, way to go.
people think of, professor, researcher. No.
Second grade teacher.
Well, teaching finger painting certainly gives you enough of a background.
Oh, who did finger painting in second grade, Brian? I'm sorry, they might have done that at your Catholic school that you grew up in. But
no, I didn't end up in Catholic school until sixth.
Oh, okay. Well, I see you missed out then.
I didn't enter Catholic school until I was old enough to know better.
Well, that's ironic, isn't it?
Yeah, it kind of backfired on my parents.
Okay, what were we discussing? Oh, yes. See, I told you. I told you to expect the unexpected here. No, I'm just curious about the whole immune boosting, because I mean that's the big fad, and I guess people want to not get colds and not get flu and that sort of thing, and it always comes back down to, like with the recent outbreak of swine flu, you know, it's like wash your hands, avoid crowds, eat healthy, and exercise. I don't know. What does it come down to?
In regards to non-pharmacological intervention and immune boosting, if I can stop being sarcastic for 5 minutes, here's, I guess, a more reasonable thing to say. And that is that, yeah, there are certain things you can do to boost your immune system. I mean, you can eat healthy diet. You can exercise. You can get plenty of sleep every night. You know, general things to be healthy. And if you, you know, find a good romantic partner and have, you know, good relationships with your family and, you know, treat your kids right and, you know, and eat your post-toasties, you know, then generally you're going to probably be healthier. And it's probably because your immune system is in a more solid and healthy state. So you can sort of, I guess, quote, boost your immune system by doing some of these kinds of activities. You know, what's that old thing? That guy used to eat granola or whatever. You know, eat that. You got, you know, whatever.
Oh, Wilford Brimley.
Yeah, whatever. Anyway, so the point is, though, that there's things you can do to, you know, to generally be a healthier person.
Right.
And have, you know, fewer colds and flus and illness and that sort of thing. But, you know, in regards to non-pharmacological interventions and that type of activity, you know, being healthier in that respect sometimes can be, to some extent, psychological. You know, so if you're stressed all the time and you're not eating right and you're not sleeping and you know, and you're going to catch colds more often and be more sick, right? But if you're feeling good and thinking positively and you know, you might be more healthy, right? Well, if wearing juju beads makes you feel more confident and secure, or if having a crystal rock of some variety in your pocket that you can touch in like a safety blanket or something, or what do you call those things kids have? Something blanket.
Binkies?
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. say you have a pacifier that you can suck on or whatever,
right.
You know. I mean, if you have something that makes you more self-confident and makes you more comfortable and happy and well-adjusted and whatnot, then that could have some immunological effect and, you know, that's positive and you could be healthier and as a result. I mean, if you meet somebody and you fall in love and you have a good relationship, you know, generally you're going to be healthier and happier. You're going to have a better look on your face when people see you and whatnot.
You'll be better fed if it's the right person.
Exactly. Oh, okay. Well, that was a personal attack.
No, it wasn't. That was a personal affirmation.
Well, yeah. That's a better way to say it.
Yes.
Well, do you think some of this can be, like, retroactive in a sense? As I'm thinking of an old quote. The last time I had a cold, I didn't do anything, and I had it for 2 weeks, but this time I caught a cold, and I took some homeopathic treatment, and it only lasted 14 days.
And you have kind of a
memory if you've made some kind of a lifestyle change, or you're taking a new supplement, or you're doing something like that. It seems to me, it also reminds me of people describing giving birth, which is, by all accounts that I've heard, enormously painful. People tend not to remember it as quite as painful after the fact. And would that be possibly something that goes into this NPI, a kind of retroactive idea that even though you've already gone something or gone through something that was somewhat unpleasant, the memory of it is diminished? So do you think that also has an effect? Does that help in the long run?
That was really a good attempt at asking a question, but I'm not exactly sure where that was going.
I'm not entirely. Well,
I think we're back to the whole eyewitness thing again, our perception of what happened.
Right, exactly. But, I mean, that's – what am I trying to say, Jamie?
You got me there this time, Brian. I'm sorry.
That's okay. You can start – you can just totally say something completely different.
Okay, rewind. Let's go.
Right, well, I'll just edit that part out. I was thinking of the retroactive aspect of the placebo effect. Can that be therapeutic in the long run? Do people tend to do better if they perceive the illness they went through as being lessened? Does that help them in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the reason I didn't understand the question was just simply because, you
know, probably because I spoke it very badly.
No. I think actually you probably didn't do that. It's just that, you know, my knowledge, I mean, of being in the situation where I'm catching a baby as it comes out of a womb, in that situation, you know, women are usually filled with all types of hormones and immune agents and pharmacological agents that we've slipped into their spinal cord. So generally speaking, they're sort of drunk and intoxicated with all these things that aren't normally floating around in their bloodstream. And so it makes perfect sense that they're not going to necessarily remember the events exactly the way they happened.
Twilight.
Well, I was kind of thinking of accounts of people who have had, you know, natural birth where they don't take any of the drugs to deaden the pain.
Believe me, natural birth, it is human physiology that when a woman is delivering a baby, her body is absolutely flooded with things that aren't normally found in her body.
I can attest to that fact because I did have two home births and completely unmedicated, and I can't say that either one of them were painful. That's not the word I would describe at all. It was strenuous. It was laborious. But it was not actually painful. And you know, I think it's because I was prepared for that situation. And to get back to this whole idea of informing your patients, I still have this lingering idea that somehow you have to have them trick themselves, or that you have to teach them how to trick themselves. I mean, there's still sort of this deception goes on.
For example, with hypnosis, I mean, you can clearly do this. I mean, we have studies where people learn how to do hypnosis. You know, first of all, when we talk about hypnosis, this is a very common misperception. You cannot, wave your fingers and some electricity goes from your fingers to somebody's brain, and then you can force them to do anything you want. You tell them, right? That's not how hypnosis works. Hypnosis, the person undergoing the hypnosis has to want to do whatever. You can't go rob a bank under hypnosis and they go rob a bank. You can't do that, right?
Right.
Hypnosis is where an individual gives his personal autonomy over to a hypnotherapist who's sort of directing him what to do. But the person doing the subject wants to do this, right?
Right.
And so it's just that they have a hard time doing it under normal circumstances, but under the focus and the, of the hypnotic trance, they're able to do it. But it's something that the patient wants to do, right? Now, I can't remember where we were going with that.
Preparing your client or your patient in a non-deceptive way. It still seems to me like a placebo effect. You're going to have to train them to trick themselves.
Right. So for example, with hypnosis, you can train somebody to do hypnosis where then the point of the hypnosis is analgesia. Let's say they have low back pain, and so you're trying to get rid of the low back pain with the hypnosis. You train the person to do the self-hypnosis, and then the self-hypnosis works and their low back pain gets better, and you image their brain with a PET or fMRI or SPECT scan, and you can actually see places in the brain that normally produce natural endorphins lighting up, and the person actually is experiencing pain relief, and they're doing self-hypnosis. And that's almost the same studies were done with acupuncture and with a number of other non-pharmacological type interventions. For example, when you treat people with antidepressant medications and you see parts of their brain light up that indicate that the antidepressant medications are working, or you treat somebody with cognitive behavioral psychotherapy and you take the same brain images and you see similar parts of the brain lighting up. And so, you see real treatment effects occurring in the brain that correspond with clinical improvement. And you've given a non-pharmacological intervention. And so the thing is that we have sort of a wealth now, really gaining momentum, of all of these different and sundry non-pharmacological approaches, all kind of able to do the same sort of thing. And in general, it requires a fully informed patient who is
consenting,
cooperating with the therapy.
It sounds an awful lot like what goes on in the brains of religious people when they're trying to when they're trying to pray for their headache to go away. It often does.
Yeah. Sorry for the insult a minute ago. Now I'm going to come down with a very – that's awesome. That's perfect, very analogous, excellent thing to say.
And further than that, being raised Catholic, I've seen evidence that Catholics, as they're against birth control, I think they've been – attempting to use NPI birth control for an awfully long time.
That's right.
It doesn't work.
The classic non-pharmacological intervention for birth control is when your boyfriend says, "Oh, baby, you can't get pregnant if it's your first time."
That's right. Or whatever else is going on. Whatever straw you can grasp at. Well, I see that we are up with our time, and it's been a real pleasure. Dr. Morgan Levy, psychiatrist and research scientist. His specialty is geriatrics and Alzheimer's disease, and we've been talking about acupuncture, placebo medicine, and religion.
You've been listening to the Rational Alchemy interviews. For more interviews, podcasts, feedback, blogs, and more, visit rational-alchemy.com.